Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood. I was going to say of the Vinnie Eastwood show, but I'm pretty episodic as well. Today, however, we are going to be shifting our focus from, you know, the entire world and everything that's completely messed up, and we're just going to be focusing on New Zealand for a moment here, when we have two guests today from this little island Alcatraz exile situation that we all face. So my first guest today is Vince Seema from kiwisfirst.co.nz, noted court watchdog. In fact, come to think of it, the court watchdog in New Zealand. Because if anybody's done any research into the New Zealand courts,
there's nobody watching what they're doing.
Except for him. Vince Seema, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, Professor Eastwood. That was quite kind. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, what did I say the other day? I think it was self-sacrifice for the greater good, right? And you'll find out that the people who do that don't usually see the benefits, right? It's usually people who come afterwards who don't even know your name or the deeds that you've done.
Well, we can all hope that's the case for both of our sakes.
Yeah, if you say so. All right, so give us a little bit of an update of what's been happening in the generalized scumbaggery of the New Zealand courts as of late.
Well, secrecy still rules. Traditionally, the New Zealand courts have, right before Christmas, released their most problematic judgments, hopefully under the cover of holidays, so nobody really pays much attention to them. Their minds are focused on the holidays. And this year, in 2015, was no exception. A very notable published judgment was on the 18th of December, which was in Greer versus Smith, which was a habeas corpus action originally, I believe, and but it was impossible to tell from the judgment earlier in 2015 what was actually what the issue was. Habeas corpus is Latin for bring the body before the court. It's generally used for alleged oppression by the government to hold somebody without writ or warrant. So it's called the Great Writ, in that it has the power. It's an application that any citizen can make, but it has the power of a court order, in that it compels the person holding someone's liberty to bring them before court. The Supreme Court dealt with this, but when you read the judgment, there was nothing that could really tell what the issues were, the legal arguments. So I sought to find out what the actual application for leave was. The problem is, in the New Zealand Supreme Court, believe it or not, the highest court in the land, it's impossible to get anything other than the published judgment. Now, of course, the problem that causes in the face of corruption, it allows judges basically to write their own report without any instilling in discipline of what the actual submissions are that people can refer to and say, did they actually address it? The Supreme Court of New Zealand refuses to make those public. In fact, applications for access to the applications, the appeals to the court, are routinely dismissed. They're dismissed by private minutes, so people don't even know they're being dismissed. But right before
it's like 20 layers of secrecy.
Oh, yeah, at least 15. But they've made it official now. Usually, in any other democracy, you're supposedly particularly the courts, because they make they're supposed to set the guide for the rest of the government, are supposed to be transparent. That's why we have public courts. That's why we have a public record. That's why we have a searchable public record, so that people in the country who are law abiding can access it and see what the courts are ruling. So not only that they can see what they are expected to do as law-abiding citizens, but to hold the judges equally accountable for upholding the statutes and other common law that are the legal fabric of our society. But what we had here before on the 18th is the judges, all five members of the Supreme Court, convened in private on their own motion without notice, hearing, submissions from anyone, and came out with an 11-paragraph decision which says that they are able individually to make decisions on access, applications for access to court records, deny them in their chambers by private minute, and those denials are unappealable. Well, that violates the fundamental rule of law principle in that it wasn't public, but also not reviewable. But the issues themselves weren't before the courts. What we had here is the judges bringing up the law on their own. It wasn't something that Steamer versus Eastwood and I raise an issue, a legal issue in respect to you as a defendant, and then we argue it. The court decided an issue that Greer didn't care about it, and Smith, the defendant, didn't care about. The court used the opportunity of a request for access to the record to convene on the legal questions, and that's just that violates constitutional law. Judges can't make law on their own motion. They are there to interpret legislation and apply it, but only on applications from other parties. So this is quite significant. It's a breach, fundamental breach of the Constitution. And if you look at the Justice Ministry website, it says the New Zealand Constitution, while unwritten, is the cornerstone of our legal system. I know you're speechless, right?
When it comes to legal stuff, in inverted commas, people just glaze over the go, oh, what's the significance of that? What's the importance? In fact, they don't even ask those questions. They just walk away and they don't listen. Hence the reason why I believe the legal system has gotten as corrupt as it is and as good at concealing its scumbaggery, because it's very easy to conceal things from people who just can't be bothered looking for them.
Well, it's unconscious ignorance. You don't know what you don't know, and you don't know that because there's no record of it that you can see. So some of the greatest corruption and skullduggery can be occurring simply because, not because someone's not watching, but because the people who are doing it are not allowing it to be seen. And that's very important. You know, this kind of secrecy is the foundation for allowing corruption. And the UN recognizes this. That's why it says that, not only that, 2005, Parliament passed the Public Records Act, which required the Supreme Court to keep an accurate record and to make it publicly accessible. Now, I understand people's eyes glaze over when you get too much into the legalese, but I have to stress how important this is. We have the decision in Greer versus Smith, which had nothing to do with either party. Again, these judges convening on their own motion to decide legal questions, that says that they are not accountable to anyone and they can keep their records secret. And they say they're operating as the High Court did pre-1973. Now, what's the significance of that? Well, it has a great amount of significance. It shows their duplicity in evading the law that binds them, because that was before the legislation was passed that allows people to access the Court of Appeal and High Court records, which were passed in civil jurisdiction in 1973 and the criminal in 1974. It's before the New Zealand Bill of Rights Act in 1990. It's before the Supreme Court Act 2003, which says it must operate like the other courts. It's before the Public Records Act 2005, which compels, as I said, the court to keep a record and allow, make it publicly accessible. And lastly, it contravenes the Court of Appeal Access to Court Documents Rules 2009, which says that the court must do this in the case of the Court of Appeal. So the significance of these judges deliberately, and we're not talking about one errant judge. We have five judges on our highest court that have done this. The significance is fundamental. It's a breach of the Constitution and the rule of law, and the Attorney General has been asked to, because he has a responsibility under the Cabinet Manual, to notify the House of Representatives of this breach of both the rule of law and the New Zealand Bill of Rights Act. It's extremely important. It's so It's difficult to find give you a comparison.
Well, here's my question, though, because even if you expose this thing in the court, what are you going to do? Arrest the judges and take them to the corrupt court?
Well, yeah, they're not accountable to begin with. But the reason we have the separation of powers doctrine, where you have the executive and the legislative branch and the judicial branch, is that the other two keep them in check. Well, what we have here is right before Christmas is the Supreme Court passing law. And not only passing law that they say breaches every major piece of legislation passed in the 43 years since 1973 that deals with courts keeping records. So it would be like Parliament convening and saying that they're overturning the court judgments of the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeal, saying we're a new administration, we've just kicked out the last party, and as a result, we don't like these decisions, and we're throwing them out. That's a fair comparison. And why people don't recognize that it's that severe a breach of the rule of law is, as you said, they don't know about it. They're not paying attention. They tend to glaze over when you talk about legal issues.
I would also stress that the New Zealand media are some of the most inept, selfish, soulless scum in the globalized media. And that's saying something. And
yeah. Well,
for this thing to come under their attention, you know, just like, oh, I didn't know about that one, you don't say. You selfish, ignorant person who's not actually curious about anything except your next paycheck and your next Gucci bag and your next trip to Tahiti, you didn't know about how corrupt our court system was? How does this happen?
Well, they can't report on it. The short answer on that, Vinny, is they can't. Not that they're inclined to. I agree with you, they're not inclined to. But they can't. They're funded by the government in large part. So they cannot report on these issues because their funding gets cut and they find themselves before the court.
Whoa. That's an important thing right there. Do we actually have any instances or case studies where judicial corruption or something of that nature has been reported by a media entity such as TVNZ, which is almost wholly government-funded, or TV3, which got a $40 million bailout from the government communications minister, Stephen Joyce, who used to be their CEO? Do we have any actual, you know, right there, they report it and then their funding gets cut right afterwards? I mean, I'm not saying you're not telling the truth, bro, but it would be nice to know if there's an actual specific instance, because usually they just do it through threat and implying things, so that way they've got plausible deniability.
Well, thank you. Let's look at the mainstream media and then try to think for a moment of an investigative journalist. If you can think of any at all, the person that would come to mind.
I can't.
Yeah, I know. It's hard to think of because there really isn't one. But the closest one that comes is Brian Bruce, who's been around for a long time. And now I see that he's got a series that's running on the Crime and Investigation Network out of the U.S. But he's a New Zealander who's reporting on New Zealand issues. And when he did the child poverty story 4 years ago, the national government cut his funding. He can't get another job for anything. And he's pitching stories and other journalists who take a more favorable government position are getting the funding on the same storylines. And he's a senior journal with tremendous experience, impeccable record, but the government doesn't like him because he reported on child poverty. The government wants to say particularly that there's no poverty in New Zealand. He blew the lid off that. And as a result, he can't get funding anymore. That funding is going to places like that was going to him, now going to the New Zealand Herald, which announced recently that they're getting that type of funding on these small-scale funding projects that used to go to upcoming journalists even. They're getting that funding. And if you notice, the New Zealand Herald is not – they don't really say their news anymore. They are under the NZME umbrella, which is New Zealand Media and Entertainment. The name says it all. Our news in New Zealand is under – an umbrella which has entertainment and not news in its name. And when you look at what's on TV and you look at what's on in the paper, you've got the celebrity sightings at the beach. You've got a Maori teenager stealing a wallet if you got anything on it. You don't have all these white-collar criminals who are robbing the country blind. You'll never see that in New Zealand media anywhere. And it's occurring. I'm talking about this story. This story is major. Anywhere else in a democracy, this story would be front page. In New Zealand, you see nothing. I'm telling you about something that, while you can search the judgment and see what I'm telling you is true on the Supreme Court website, you can't find anything in the news about it. And it's because the government, John Key is trying to promote New Zealand as a investor-friendly country. And because we sit at the bottom of the world and people don't know about it, we're remote geographically, he's selling the world a bill of goods that investors should put their money here because it's a tax haven of sorts, or it's safe. We have a law-abiding system. The people are law-abiding, generally speaking, but our system is corrupt as could be. The administration doesn't want this out, plain and simple. It would be disastrous for the image that we try to present to the world. So they are lockstep with these corrupt judges in covering it up, and the judges know it, because to do so ruins the image that we want to put out there. It's sad. The victims are not only the people who live here, but the ones who unsuspectingly invest in business, the personally or whatever, and then find out all too late that it's deep-seated corruption, and you don't hear about it because it's just well covered up. You know the story, for example, that Transparency International New Zealand is 90% government funded. Now, Transparency International is a global network that's an NGO, which non-governmental organization. They're not supposed to have any government influence, let alone 90% control. We are different from the rest of the world, and we tell ourselves that's good or better. It's not. If the government's controlling all these oversight entities, oversight agencies, we have trouble. We have a government that's in control of the watchdog. It's not a situation that breeds good behavior.
It's the fox guard in the hen house has become such a cliche, especially in New Zealand, that it's just no longer used anymore, because people don't even recognize there's a fox guard in the hen house. They just reckon he was the one with the hammers and nails that built the fucker, right? That's the whole thing. We have a system that was built on corruption, that is maintained by corruption, and is grown by corruption. It is the air. It is the carbon dioxide. It is the sunlight. It is the water. It is the only nutrient that the government has anymore. To steal, to lie, to cover up, and to destroy people's lives.
And unfortunately for you and I and everybody else in New Zealand and abroad who has any interest in New Zealand, is it's easy for the government here to do it. A country of 4 million people or a bit more, and the lack of having to spend money in any large quantities on any kind of army defense or anything else, foreign aid, you're allowed to, you can very easily spend the $500,600,000 they give to the local chapter of Transparency International New Zealand, for example, to focus outside of New Zealand and to give New Zealand a big tick as not corrupt. It's insidious, but at the same time, it's great value. $500,000 for the government to get that kind of value. Larger governments.
They're playing with loaded dice in a game that's already rigged.
Well, that's a good analogy. Fair one. And they rig it and they have to load the dice on top of it.
What was his name? Graham McCready prosecuting, I think it was John Banks successfully, and then that prosecution gets overturned. Right. And then trying to prosecute John Key, the Prime Minister, had a dossier that's like, it's actually as thick as my arm, right? And gets thrown out by the court, okay? And it was funny because yourself and Penny Bright spoke to Graham a number of years ago, and I interviewed him outside the court one day. And he said, oh, when Vince Seymour and Penny Bright came to tell me how corrupt the country was, I just thought they were nuts. But now I think that they were being very conservative. It is just like that, you know. Do you feel sometimes, Vince, that it's actually impossible to quantify just how corrupt it is, because most of the facts are indeed concealed and we can't even quantify the size of the entirety of the problem? It's actually just too much for the human mind, because there's so many schemes running, there's so many plans, so many participants, and most of them are unaware of each other's existence.
Yeah, well, Graham McCready was a great—he was typical of people I speak to, because he was up and coming in as far as exposing this stuff, and I told him he was in for. And I remember as clear as yesterday the blank look I had that he had on his face. He wasn't comprehending what I was saying, but now he knows. But of course, this John Banks thing is a perfect example too. And while that's been a couple years ago now. I mean, he was convicted. Okay, so it was overturned on appeal. Sometimes that happens. It looks a little fishy, but that's not the problem, Benny. The problem is that the Court of Appeal barred him from retrial. Now, what's up with that? That's, you know, that only comes in cases of gross crown or prosecutorial misconduct. That didn't occur in the Banks case. This is insane. Somebody, that was a quid pro quo. Banks had something on some judges that you can pretty safely bet that he was going to expose if they send him to prison or upheld his conviction. And they had to go beyond just because they knew he would be convicted again. So they not only overturned it, but they barred him from the crown from prosecuting him again. That's an indication of what we see here all the time, and people just get immune to it. They think this is normal. It's not normal.
Vince, I don't want to like take this into a dark area or something that's outside your expertise, so I'll just offer this as a factoid. According to the news, mainstream news, John Banks is like one of the, if not the, highest ranking Freemason in the country. And allegations that I've heard from a lot of people is that many of the top judges are also Masons. Now, they have a code where they're not allowed to reveal any secrets and things of that nature, and they always have to help each other. Now, a layman might look at those little instances and then look at how John Banks's trial was handled and then see a connection. I don't know what your awarenesses of that element, though.
Well, I don't know anything about the Freemasons. I don't know about any of the connections, so I can't speak about it. But what I can say, and this is well known, is we have what everybody innocuously refers to as an old boys network here. And that is a quid pro quo arrangement, is I'll scratch you back if you scratch mine. And most of the time, well, some of the time at least, there's little, if any, concern whether what that scratching of the back, whether it's legal or not. It's considered to be that they rationalize it. No one's, they say, well, I'm not murdering anybody. No one's getting hurt. What they're doing is they're stealing the country blind, and they're saying nobody's getting hurt. I think that is, you know, that's how they rationalize it from what I see. But that old boy network does exist. We have cases of judges who are overturning decisions on their own motion. There was another case before the Supreme Court, and it involves Ian Wishart in a book he wrote. It came out the 18th of December as well, again, under cover of Christmas holidays. The Supreme Court decision is on the Supreme Court website. It's Smallwood versus London or something like that. But it speaks of how the high court judge, there was a defamation claim went before a jury, and the jury found defamation. I think they awarded $220,000. The judge, on his own motion, a week later, overturned the decision. Now, No one asked him to do that. The parties didn't ask him to. He did it. Why would he do that? Because it is unlawful. Judges don't have that kind of discretion. They at least have to be asked by one of the parties with a reason why. He said that he saw an affidavit from somebody who was after the proceeding ended, who contradicted some of the evidence. Well, that's bogus too, because somebody who couldn't be bothered to give evidence before the hearing only gives it by affidavit afterwards, and they can't be cross-examined on the evidence. You can't rely on someone like that. But that's what the judge said he did. And it went all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, when you read the decision, they said there's no practical benefit in us giving leave to allow this appeal. That's scary stuff.
Oh, God.
I know. This is what's happening week in and week out at our highest court, and you don't know about it because it's not being reported. Legal stuff makes people, go to sleep. And even lawyers are like sheep. They're afraid to speak out because they will be hammered by the law society for being critical of the system. That's how we operate here. The watchdogs, the ones who are duly critical and righteously indignant at the corruption that's occurring, are the ones that are punished, not the perpetrators.
Well, this comes to the conclusion that the justice system isn't there to punish criminality. It's there to facilitate it, isn't it? But only at the highest levels.
Oh, well, let's make a distinction here. I disagree with it because I make a little subtle – well, it's not too subtle a distinction. White-collar crime that's embedded by the good old boys is viciously protected and considered lawful. And there's no limits on the secrecy they will resort to cover it up. But if a Maori teenager steals an old beat-up car, then we see it on the news, and we'll actually have cameras in court. There's a disproportionate not only way that they apply the law, but report on it. You won't see these cases what did you hear about the one of Ian Wishart right before Christmas? That wasn't reported on. That's only because I watch what's happening in the Supreme Court that I know about it. But I also know that they use the Christmas holidays to hide their dirty laundry.
Well, see, that's the problem with paying attention, is it stresses you out. You know, no wonder reporters don't report on this or pay any attention to it. I mean, they don't want to have, a life that has stress in it. You know, I'm just here to report the news. I don't want to have the stress about it. Okay, let me just back this up a bit. The media's job is to keep a watch on the powerful and the corrupt because they're dangerous enough to fuck everybody simultaneously. Okay? Now, when your job as a journalist is not to do that, but instead just to look at people who steal $100, steal a car, or murder a single person or something like that, because that person is Maori, it'll get everybody uppity, it'll trigger the nice little pleasure erogenous zones for the overwhelming redneck racists in this fucking country. You know, that kind of thing. It gets hits. All right, now I've got a YouTube channel, and I know about getting hits. However, I don't get a hell of a lot because I only try to report and put videos up of things that are real, all right? Things that are actually of consequence. As a result, about 90% of the population will never search for it, and even if they did, they wouldn't understand it, and they would probably leave some kind of abusive comment, okay? Let me just tell you, New Zealand journalists, what I'm doing is actually journalism. You're supposed to report and only report the things that people don't want you to report.
That is your only job. If you do your, you know, so-called service, and that translates into doing everything your editor tells you and cutting out important facts just because you're going to get fired as a result, you need to get another job. Okay? It's just that simple. Or stop calling yourself a journalist, because you're not one. You are a reporter. You are merely a mouthpiece and a puppet for people who are more powerful, more corrupt, and more vacuous and soulless than even you. Sorry if I just kind of like went on a rant there, because...
No, the issue here is exactly what you're saying. They're not reporting it. That's a fact. But I think there's a culture problem. There's a level of apathy. As you know, you would know as well as anyone, that the level of apathy here is what allows these perpetrators to continue as they do. But so that, and within that, there's the people who just don't care. And then there's the ones that don't believe you. It just affects their sensibilities that they just can't believe you. And you mentioned Graham McCready. So even people who've had some experience but haven't peeled back the onion enough still can't believe. And I can tell you, Vinny, when this is happening to people, it is extremely common that they still can't believe it. They keep telling themselves, oh, this is a – I've got one bad judge. I've got one crooked lawyer. There's just the clerk at the courthouse is corrupt. You know, they try to rationalize it's just one isolated situation. No, this is a very well-connected puzzle, and all the pieces operate together, and that's what people don't realize, and many find out far, far too late. You know, I say in the case of .com, as soon as he runs out of money, then he'll run out of his ability to go to court. As long as he's feeding the good old boys in the system. And by the way, did you know that his former lawyer, Davison, is now a high court judge, was appointed in December? This is how we do things here. So, you know, and he's a son of a former judge as well. So, of course, we keep it close in the family. But nothing was going to happen with .com as long as he's paying for Davis's services and feeding the good old boys. And that's justice in New Zealand. It's justice a lot of places. The thing is that we have absolutely no oversight or reporting of it. And as a result, we believe it doesn't exist. And that's unfortunate.
So how can we solve this problem? Because you're the only one really doing this as a full-time. Penny occasionally helps you out. I occasionally help you out, but it's not enough really to get the general public on board, really, is it? And it's actually, I don't think it's possible without an enormous, freely available television station that is constantly reporting the real news to New Zealanders, and even then, it might take a decade for the cognitive dissonance to wear off and people to wake up from it. It's not a hopeless situation. I don't believe in like hopelessness. But it's not got a big light, you know, ray at the end of the tunnel. I don't see this getting into the forefront. I don't see it heating up. I don't see it becoming a bigger issue for New Zealanders. In the years that we've known each other, I've only seen the issues you've discussed be swept even further and further under the rug, and the loss of liberty and justice for the New Zealand people become greater and greater. Do you believe that there might be a point where people have actually had enough, where they will start paying attention, or do they need to personally be fucked over by the system before they will sit up and take notice?
Well, invariably it happens. We don't know what that tipping point is or when it's going to happen. And there's a lot of the factors that come into play. Generally speaking, when people's when you take away people's expectations, that's when they start to focus on what is actually occurring. Right now, the weather's nice here. It's safe to walk the streets. We live in what we believe a bubble, in that there's no visible signs of oppression. But when it's a festering sore, and as that grows, it's going to become more and more apparent. And no one can say when that's going to happen before people start recognizing it. But what I can say, Vinny, is we've seen a huge escalation of this since we lost the Privy Council. The Privy Council was effective oversight, and it was independent. It was not part of the good old boys network. It was, outside this little village that we live in. But now we have the Supreme Court as the reason for this interview, the story today. The Supreme Court, right before Christmas, ruling that they can keep everything secret, that they have that power, even though it flies in the face of every fundamental doctrine of transparency in any democracy. They say they can do it here in New Zealand.
So they're a public court of record that is not public and doesn't have any records.
Refuses to release a record. Refuses. And they can do it in private. They've ruled that they can do that in private. That's unbelievable. Unbelievable. The fact that we've reached a point where they've done that tells me two things. One is they've got a lot to hide. And second, that we are hitting a tipping point. They are resorting to outwardly breaking the law and the Constitution to protect their patch. When that happens, there's no going back. How are they going to correct it? Now, what happens is we don't care about it because it's not getting reported, and we don't like to get into the legal technicalities and intricacies that just bore us. But other countries who are looking at New Zealand, like Australia and China and the U.S., that are major trading partners and have other diplomatic association in the U.K., they see what's occurring, and they increasingly are scratching their heads as that the decisions are coming out of a highest court, and they are saying something's just not right. And we saw it, Vinny, when that judge came over, Gleason, Murray Gleason. You remember the other thing that I exposed was with Bill Wilson. He resigned from the Supreme Court for acting in a conflict of interest. Well, not acting, but presiding in a conflict of interest. And it ended up with him resigning from the bench. Well, New Zealand was going to show that they were transparent, so they had Murray Gleason, a retired judge from Australia, come over. Big fanfare. Government was paying for him to do a private investigation. And then all of a sudden, he's gone. He left literally in the middle of the night. No one heard anything about it. Nothing more was reported. Despite all the fanfare of him coming in, his report was never released. The government paid tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars for a report that they never allowed to be released. Now, if they were bringing him over to be transparent, and then they decide not to publish anything he says, that's a pretty clear indication that they've got something to hide. This is how we operate. They thought that this judge that they came over and hired would play ball with them. I don't know why. Well, apparently he wasn't going to. He was going to my inside sources say that he was going to blow the lid off of it. His report was going to say, not only is there a problem with Bill Wilson here, but the whole system's sick. He is a symptom of a sick system rather than a single bad judge. That was his report, and that couldn't be allowed to see the light of day. And this isn't unique. The Canadian judge, Binney, came over here on the David Bain. He came over to assess whether Bain got a fair trial and determined that he was likely innocent and that the injustice to Bain was greater than anybody believed. Well, what happened? Judith Collins came out and said he was a no good judge, blah blah blah, and didn't know what he was talking about. Well, they hired him. He's a retired Superior Court judge from Canada. They hired him. They thought he was good until they disagreed with what they wanted him to say. This is how we do things. We want to show that we're transparent and have these outsiders come in and evaluate what we're doing. But the minute they say that, oh, you got a problem here, they're the bad ones. They're the ones that need to be raked over the coals, and that's what we do. That's our culture.
Well, we've got it. Okay, when the public is out for blood, they do not react in a satisfied manner until they're thrown a piece of meat. All right. So if there's some kind of big crime or whatever big criminals are involved, just go, okay, who's one lower level henchman that we can throw to the wolves here and then get off scot-free? You know, like Hewlett, like Peter Hewlett, for example. For those who don't know, Hewlett Wealth Management took in millions upon millions of dollars from Kiwi investors, and it was all basically made of sand. The three people who signed off on their documents to say it's not made on sand is John Banks. Perhaps you remember that name from the earlier part of the interview. And Don Brash, who is a former head of the National Party, and Peter Hewlett. Now, guess which one of the not members of the Old Boys Network went to jail? And guess which two got off scot-free and probably continue to commit crimes to this day?
Yeah, that's really sad. And that's an absolute true example you gave. Again, we have so many of these, and people just don't seem to care about it. It is fundamentally unjust, but it also gives us all cause for worry. But we don't tend to believe it affects us until it actually does, and then it's too late, of course. So,
you did in fact get personally affected by this. I would like you to actually explain to people what got you involved in watching the courts.
Well, I had a personal experience. I was had a corrupt lawyer who was going to be a judge, and when I exposed him to Law Society, they didn't want to hear it. They said that he'd done everything right, so that I filed suit against him. He twice offered me $175,000 to settle. I didn't do it, and next thing I know, I'm falling down a rabbit hole where I'm getting attacked left, right, and center by the judges. I'm going to court, and I'm producing evidence, and the judges are variously saying that evidence is suppressed, or they come out 2 days later and say that I agreed to something that I didn't, and you go to get the transcript, and the transcript's not there. Oh, it is absolutely unbelievable. You know, I feel like I'm telling a story to the Graham McCreadys out there who won't believe what I'm saying, but I can tell you it happens. It is so common here, and there's just no instilling discipline. That's why the watchdogs, that's why the public records, that's why the recordings in court are so important. They do provide a discipline when the judges are trying to protect their mates, that they get caught out. But unfortunately, we just don't have that yet. I'm the one that's pushing for it, making slow incremental progress, but it is hard slogging. There's no question about it. It's hard. And so many, many times I say, why am I even doing this? So many people don't care. But there are people, you've mentioned other people, Graham McCreadys a little bit. He's done certain things, not to the extent like a Penny Bright and a Grace Hayden, but there are a number of people out there who are pushing for transparency and justice systematically through the systems that are there to,
Well, people are coming at it from all angles, you know, many hands make light work. The problem is we're not always working together and on the same side, and you kind of feel like you're alone, right, to a large degree, because you have to do that work and other people are doing their work and so on and so forth. It's not exactly a team effort or not a you know, a big happy workplace and everything. But when we do get together at protests and everything, we have a great laugh because we're all experiencing and exposing the same kind of crap, and it's nice to just be around people who understand that, you know. Now, I think that everyone who lives today owes a large part of the good things in their life
again, to people they'll never know the names of who committed deeds they'll never hear about. And when you fight for what's right, it's usually other people that reap the benefits. It's self-sacrifice, which is a concept that few leaders understand, right? And it just seems that people always just kind of like, they diss you, right? They try to belittle and counter everything that you're saying as if they've got some kind of evidence on their side, when the reality is they've only got ignorance. They don't know what they're talking about. They don't know who they're talking to, and they don't know who they're talking to and what they're talking to them about, right? It's insane. I think if you're talking to somebody, it feels like you're talking with an arrogant, educated idiot that believes everything they hear, except if it conflicts with their current program, a subset of beliefs. All right. It's pretty much like that. The rest won't come into view. Not entirely dissimilar from how people in the, I believe it was the Bahamas, could not see Christopher Columbus's ships because they had nothing in their consciousness or their experience that could even quantify what a ship is. And they couldn't see it. Only the shaman could see it. And it was only through the shaman enlightening all the other people that they could finally see sails and a hull and that kind of thing just materializing out of the water, and these men with helmets and guns coming aboard to their island to enslave them, right? And or trade with them and have sex with their women. But some people are just so asleep that a bucket of cold water it's just not going to do it, I don't think, right? And
I see that.
I just kind of come up with this concept of the endless war model of life. You know, it's six basic principles. Vinnie Eastwood's six rules for fighting an endless war against scumbaggery. Number one, I'm going to die anyway, so I'd rather die fighting. Number two, I probably can't win, but I have a moral obligation to resist. Number three, I'm terrified of what might happen to me, but I'm even more frightened of doing nothing. Number four, just because we're being exterminated doesn't mean we can't make it fun. Otherwise, what's the point of being killed? Number five, don't worry, it's just the end of the world. And number six, don't stress. Things are probably a lot worse than you think they are.
Oh, good.
It's he who can find humor amidst despair is he who can snatch victory from the jaws of defeat.
Mm.
But yeah, it still doesn't make it any easier.
No, the thing is, I don't think we'll ever get to a point where people come together and protest to the extent where they are in unison, like the factions that perpetrate the injustice. And I'll give you another example on shows the unanimity of the judges, is when this register of pecuniary interest of judges bill was proposed 3-4 years ago. Big fanfare. Oh, this is going to prevent another judge like Wilson resigning in disgrace, and by having judges declare their financial interest so that do it up front. So even if they sit on a case, we'll know straight away that they've got a conflict. Well, in all the parties, many of the parties, except for National, I think, came out and said, oh, this is a really good concept. Sounds like a really good thing. And so it looked like it had support. Well, I told Kennedy Graham, who was the Green MP who sponsored it when he did it, I said, now that I know enough about the judges here, they're all related, for one thing. They all think alike, they will kill it by lobbying Parliament. Now, they ended up filing a submission against the pecuniary interest of judges bill. Vinny, every judge, supposedly, according to the submissions, agreed with it. Now, where in the world would you get every member of another court or legislature to agree to anything? Now, and the more important thing is that they were all opposed. Every judge in New Zealand was opposed to the bill. What was diabolical in their submission is they said, well, the concept's good, and the concept's good for the rest of the world, but it's not necessary in New Zealand. So we're somehow different. But that was telling to me, because they're all saying, oh, this is good law, but it's good law for somebody else. And yet every judge, not one dissented. That tells you something. And the reasons why they said it was bad bill for New Zealand was because judges would not go to the bench, or, you know, we'd lose some of our best legal minds to the bench because they wouldn't want that invasion into their privacy, and that it would open themselves up to bloggers giving out things like their address and other personal information about them, which is absolute nonsense. But they said it would make judges personal targets for their private and personal interests. So it's but that, again, I don't think you'd find that anywhere else. And that shows that these judges are not independent. You know, lawyers are appointed to the bench to bring independence. They're supposed to. And the reason we have appellate courts is they're supposed to give an independent review and bring an independent mind to the issue that's before them, even if it's their friend that was at the court below. Well, I just gave you an example where every judge was opposed to this bill, and as a result, they killed the bill. Not one dissenter. That wouldn't happen elsewhere. And that's uniquely New Zealand example, which happens so often here, is indicative of our problem. We are having people who are appointed to the bench that are from the same ilk, think the same way, belong to the same clubs, married with one another, went to the same schools, overwhelmingly born and raised in New Zealand, and overwhelmingly white European origin. You know, there's no Chinese or Indian judges on the high court out of 60 some judges. There's, I think, two that would consider themselves Maori. The rest are all white Europeans. And we've got on the court, we've got Court of Appeal. We have three that are related within first cousins. We have a husband and wife. We have two brothers. And who knows? It's hard to keep up. The thing is that they try to hide all that information too. I'm the one that only one in New Zealand who publishes this on Kiwis First about the judges' relationships with one another, their company relationships, what they invest in, what companies they control. This is information that I publish.
You know, Vince, I'm sorry, we've just come to the end of the segment here. And ladies and gentlemen, I want to remind you to go to kiwisfirst.co.nz or .co.nz, as we like to say here in this little colonial country. and I say the first syllable of country operatively. I think that if you are going to court in New Zealand and you find out the name of your judges or your lawyers or anything like that, do what I do. You search their name on the kiwisfirst.co.nz database, and you'll come up with, if they're a bad lawyer or a bad judge, you'll find a bit of information on them on that website. That is the service that is offered, and I want to encourage people to donate and help spread the word about kiwisfirst.co.nz and Vince Seymour and New Zealand corruption. We'll be back in just another minute. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Please go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. That's Vinnie with a Y, because it's the most important question in Eastwood. Like, go ahead, make my news. And do me a favor. I'm broke as a mofo right now, so if you could, like, start putting a monthly donation down, like $5 a month or something like that, I would very much appreciate it right about now. My very special guest joining me today is the owner of Rush FM at rushfm.co.nz and host of the Vedic Wisdom Program. And his name for this interview is, I think it's Advaita.
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 I'd waiter, yeah.
It's kind of like invited, but yeah, Italian. So he's like, invited.
Yeah, you know. Well, thanks for having me. Thanks for inviting me on, Vinny. It's always an enjoyable experience.
Would you be able to actually define for me what Vedic, what your Vedic wisdom program is actually about? Because this is something that's totally new for me.
Okay. The Vedic wisdom is derived from the Vedic scriptures. The Vedic scriptures are the oldest scriptures in existence, and they are on all the planets. And the Vedic wisdom is a scientific understanding of God realization, as opposed to religion or beliefs. And what it is it brings it to a scientific understanding of the interaction of the living entities and the Supreme Personality. To start on a basic platform, I guess, we know ourselves, we sense ourselves to be eternal living entities, but we're in a temporary body. Nobody gets out of here alive concept. Well, if we're an eternal living entity, God is an eternal living entity, then there must be a dormant eternal relationship. That's a scientific analysis, as simple as that. So from that point of view, there is a dormant relationship, and the Vedic knowledge is to awaken that relationship so you're back to seeing things in proper perspective.
What is that proper perspective, like the perspective of divinity or something like that?
Well, kind of. It starts at the base and works to the top. In the sense that if you step back and from a spiritual point of view analyze this material world we're living in, there's only two substances here, spirit and matter. So matter is in all the multiple varieties of earth, water, fire, air, mind, intelligence, ego. All of those platforms are material manifestations and permutations. And then there is you and I, the eternal spiritual conscious beings. And we get through the facilities of nature, we get a wide variety of different bodies in which to experience our desires.
So it's kind of like a lens that you're looking through.
To a degree, or driving a car. You're using your body as a vehicle to come and go, to analyze, to do, experience, etc.
Well, that's interesting, using science to sort of find God, because the people who did the Large Hadron Collider tried to do that. for those of you who don't know.
Yeah, I've always wondered, how can they need a multi-kilometer device to shoot a minute atom?
Well, let me bring the audience up to speed on this one for those who don't know. It's basically a giant particle accelerator that's buried under the ground in Europe that costs $8 billion to build. Now, what these scientists wanted to do is smash a couple particles together at high speed in the hopes that they'd figure out how the universe was created during the Big Bang. The Big Bang, of course, was theorized by the Catholic Church, who incidentally believed God was created the universe in a Big Bang anyway. Except their original story was that the Big Bang got caused by Adam and Eve getting it on. But anyway, unfortunately, there was some risk that the particles might create a black hole and suck in the entire planet, killing everyone. So they thought, fuck it, we'll go ahead with the experiment. What happened during this experiment that cost $8 billion and threatened to kill all life on Earth? Well, the particles smashed together, and for a split second, they created a new kind of matter that disappeared instantly and had no practical benefit.
Wow.
So they called it doesn't matter.
Now that's a good one. You made my day with that one.
You're welcome.
They call it doesn't matter. Now, expensive stuff, though.
Well, have you ever noticed that it's really expensive to do things that don't matter, but it's actually free or really, really cheap to do things that are actually good?
Exactly. And that's where this Vedic wisdom program is coming from, that it isn't a matter of you adopting or altering yourself. It's up to you to reawaken the relationships. and reawaken your divine perspective. I mean, just like what we were saying, if you think about all of the material bodies, whether it's insect, plant, fish, beast, human, demigod, what have you, they're all the same living entities in the varieties of bodies. So they have, every one of them has the same thinking, feeling, willing, desire to be happy, desire to understand, desire to be eternal, as you and I do. And that gives you another perspective. I mean, the first one, of course, is you become compassionate. The ground, the grass you're walking on is a bunch of guys laying there. And all of the animals that people are slaughtering by the billions, the stuff in their mouths, all of these things are living entities just like you and I, who are in a different level of evolutionary transition from body to body to body, hopefully coming to this human form of life where we can have this kind of a discussion. We can intellectually and calmly analyze truth from illusion and get things right, help each other get things right, and get freed from this cycle of birth and death.
Can we actually be freed from the cycle of birth and death? I thought that
yes.
was kind of important.
Yes, we can.
There's an old Greek saying, the wisdom of age is planting a tree that you know you will never be able to sit under the shade of.
Okay. Well, that's kind of it, isn't it? The difference between what society has been turned into now versus society that as we want it is really moving from selfishness to selflessness. That's the major difference that has to take place. We're being trained with every tool, every trick of the book to be selfish, look after number one, and that is the prime directive. But actually, real joy and real enlightenment is selfless. I use the example of Christmas. When you're a little kid, it's gimme, 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 I want, oh boy, anticipation, anticipation. And when you get mature and older, you enjoy seeing their fulfillment. You don't want gifts. You're not trying to be fulfilled, but you enjoy fulfilling others and seeing their fulfillment. And that's what it's about. When we start to wake up out of the misconception that I'm all important and you only get one life and this is all there is, you have compassion for other living entities and you want to do good. And that's where the world has gone wrong. That's what we see is wrong. We have people that are psychopathic, psychophants, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they're completely the opposite of that. They will destroy, double cross, et cetera, you, me, and the planet. And in reality, that's not happiness. Nobody gets there that way.
Happiness is not an easy thing for people to grasp. In fact, what was it? I believe I saw a documentary or something like that where I was interviewing a bunch of psychologists, and one of the scenes was like a psychologist telling people that he asks his patients what makes them happy, and 9 times out of 10 they burst into tears because for the last 20 or 30 years they don't know. They haven't done what's made them happy for decades because they've been told by society is the direct opposite of achieving their dreams.
Agreed. Agreed. Now, here's the right question. Actually, you put as many people as you want in a room and you say, how many of you want to be happy? And you suddenly find out we're all brothers because everybody wants to be happy. Well, it can't be a mistake. It can't be something that isn't an inherent nature of the living consciousness. We all actually want to be happy. But we're in a temporary place where we're surrounded by the opposite. So anxiety is the common factor in our society, as opposed to everybody having a selfless attitude to encourage other people and provide other people the opportunity to be happy. It's like the idea of a smile. You smile and someone else smiles back, and on and on and on it goes. The hug situation, giving a hug. It has a positive cycle. Just like there's a negative cycle that concentrates and concentrates, there's also a positive cycle that expands and expands.
Well, how exactly? I mean, could you describe like an instance or a case study or something where this has happened to you?
Well, it certainly happens to you, me, and everybody else on a daily basis. If you see somebody sitting over there laughing and smiling, you feel uplifted. You have a tendency to want to chuckle, or you will smile at the experience or situation. It's infectious. Positiveness, being compassionate and helping, it's a human characteristic. It's a natural trait of the living being. And so you automatically respond. And again, the hug concept, when you hug someone, a real one, you know, not a superficial, hi, welcome to dinner, we're going to talk business. But when you actually hug someone that you care about, you know, it's an infectious thing. Each of you go away happier. So that's what happens. We can go around and infect each other with happiness. We can go around and support each other's development of their consciousness.
Well, I mean, I try to facilitate that as much as I can. However, I've started to notice that pain, trauma, anger, a lot of these negative emotions, often it's like a storm. A storm dissipates when the imbalance that created it disappears. So, for example, it's caused by a low pressure system. When that low pressure system dissipates, all you have left is a high pressure system, and so on. But I'm curious as to how it's possible to live a nice, happy, wonderful life without those negative storms coming up, because I believe they're actually necessary for balance.
Okay.
And growth.
Understand. Of course, everything should be taken by an intelligent person as a lesson. The good bits and the bad bits. I'm supposed to learn from all of it. But my nature is that I'm a good person and I enjoy and I interact on the good level. But what happens is we're in such a negative environment. So the only way you can get out of it is a consciousness change. And that consciousness change is provided in the Vedic knowledge by teaching you that this is not your home. This is a temporary place where you're trying to experience a variety of personal desires. But your home is in the spiritual world outside of the cycle of birth and death, where you are interacting with other living entities. You are interacting directly with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and all of it is on an encouragement, supportive, service, selfless level where everyone is experiencing just what we're all looking for.
I don't understand that, because I feel like there's a 3D universe, like we're here, we interact with it, we can talk to other people, and there's... Let's just say you can't predict what's going to come out of somebody else's mouth. So they might say something that actually changes your whole perspective on things, right? And I've noticed that many of the times that I've had conversations with people, I've changed their life after having a single conversation, because I know things that they don't. And vice versa, the reverse is also true. If somebody's telling me something I don't, it changes everything. But where I get a little bit fuzzy is getting in through that 5D, that I've got an idea in my head. It exists outside of the 3D universe because it doesn't exist yet, and it exists outside of time because it's inside my mind, and I don't know where that idea came from. The ability of human beings to transcend that block, bringing things down from 5D into the 3D reality, I think is how we manifest these things that we call divine creation and so on and so forth. Do you believe that inventions, because you're an inventor yourself, do you think your inventions come from that other realm?
Yes and no. The inspiration may come from the other realm, but the bricks and mortar, the tools and traits and the raw materials, they're all here. It's a manipulation thing from the divine inspiration. Let me go a little further with that and back to what you just said there, being this material manifestation has multiple dimensions, as you were just saying, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. There are multiple levels of perception, and the point being that all of them are of a material nature, and the nature of material manifestation is temporary. So the divine inspiration is when you are in direct relationship and communication with the supreme personality of Godhead. And the rest of it is the mind, the intelligence, the ego, the senses, the bodily working organs, the hands, feet, etc., in their capacity to manipulate matter. So it's not a hologram, as some people say. It's a temporary platform on an inferior substance. The superior substance is you and I, the conscious living beings. The inferior substance is temporary material matter.
Define.
Matter is earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, and ego. Those are all matter. And they are like shirt and coat, is the way the Vedic literature describes it. The subtle stuff is like a shirt. It's subtle. It's gently over the top of you. Your ego, true ego, identifying you're an eternal living entity. False ego, thinking you're a man or a female or whatever by this name. Then there's intelligence, which means you look at and analyze what is good for you to do or not to do. Then there's mental, which means accepting and rejecting the desires and impulses from your senses. Then there's the senses that are concerned with analyzing, experiencing, and manipulating. And then there's the material elements, dead matter, the table, water, all the different ingredients that make up the body and that make up the external manifestation we observe.
So you're able to... It's just what I'm saying, though, isn't it? You're able to kind of like tap into your own instinct, more or less, and then
that's another level. That's another level we can talk about. Yeah, that level is when you actually communicate two direction with the supreme personality of Godhead. Now, the Lord, according to the Vedic literature, the Lord is realized in three features. The first feature is when we recognize the energies are far greater than the creative capacity of any individual, we see that there is a divine intelligence, energetic someone behind it. Then there is what's known as the supersoul. Now, the supersoul can only be understood if we use the example of a candle. But if you put a candle on the table, there is an energy source worth one candle power. And I can approach it with another candle, and now I set it aside, and I have two candle power, but I did not diminish the first one. And I can do it over and over and over and over and have 20, 50, 1,000, 10,000, 200 million candle power, but I did not diminish the first candle. Similarly.
However, by the time you lit that millionth candle, the first one would have burned all the way to the nub.
There's a little puddle of wax at the bottom. Sorry, yeah. So what we have is the Lord's inconceivable potencies, because we know God's described as omnipotent. So the Lord's inconceivable potency is he can manifest separated parts just like that candle. He manifests particles called supersoul particles that accompany every living entity and reside in the heart of its body and give it connection, divine inspiration.
So that includes ants and whatnot?
That's right. Everybody. Every species. So there is an inspiration in all of it. You know, like why did the chicken cross the road? Because he had an inspiration from within to do so.
Okay.
That's the whole thing. The whole material manifestation is we have a desire, and then the way the universe works, we're inspired to try to fulfill that desire at a particular moment, because the interactions and the interwovings of the arrangement of material energy is such that that desire will get to be fulfilled right now.
Except if you're currently in a sort of low state where you do what you're told just because an authority tells you to do, and then your desire to fulfill your destiny doesn't override your, I would say, mind control.
Understood.
To the authorities that are controlling your life. Is it a way, so it's a way of breaking free, you kind of thing?
Well, it is Okay, it is definitely a methodology of breaking free because you have divine inspiration and you have a timing that you don't have otherwise. But the ideas you just brought up, that there could be outside forces that are stifling your free will, that is true. The material manifestation, the material nature, is more powerful than any given living entity. So you can see that there is a dynamic balancing act going on in the background by the super souls in conjunction with material nature to keep the manifestation and everybody getting what they deserve and oftentimes getting what they want. But you don't get 100% guarantee. We're not the demanders of emancipation. We are coping with a percentage of freedom and a percentage of entanglement.
Help. What percentage of freedom do you think we currently have? Like, we've got the freedom to eat fast food, the freedom to buy gasoline, the freedom to watch mind-numbing propaganda as a form of entertainment. But in terms of the freedom to how your life is governed and the laws in which govern it, we just had Vince Seymour on earlier, and it just seems like... If there is a God, right, and God wants us to be free and it wants us to fulfill our desires, it seems like God isn't running the country or the world. Something else is, something with the direct opposite intention.
No. The way it's going is God has given you freedom. It's limited because of the place, but you still have freedom. You could decide to turn me off and the conversation's over right this minute. You still have a degree of freedom, and your degree of freedom increases in accordance with how much you are in harmony with the divine plan. And what we have is a society that's been hoodwinked, tricked, abused, et cetera, into not being in harmony with the divine plan. And the consequence is the people are unhappy because of it. Now, as you know, there's all sorts of groups fighting for dominance and control of the living entities. They don't want us dependent upon God for guidance and inspiration. They want us dependent on them for the necessities of life. So we find that there is a coming confrontation to where every individual living entity is going to have to make a choice with the limited amount of freedom he has. And the Lord, as the super soul, is watching to see, are you going to make a choice out of selfless will and out of your own determination and intelligence? Or are you going to be pushed into something by lethargically going along with the crowd and accepting this inhibitions or restrictions upon your freedoms? Because your free will is still active.
Well, it's a tough thing as well, because I found that the exercise of free will and actually being free aren't necessarily the same things.
Agreed.
Yeah, because for me, free will is something that's not actually manifest in the physical reality until you choose to use it, you know?
Exactly. Yes, that's right. There are people that surrender their free will, and there are people that ardently protect it.
How does psychopaths actually blend into this?
Well...
Users and stealers and abusers and the lying, thieving scum. You've had some instances. I know personally from back in the day, people have stolen and been incredibly unscrupulous to you. Where do you think they fit in with the divine plan, etc.?
There's always two components to that. One is that you deserved it. In some other perception of life, in some other lifetime, you may have caused it to come back on you on a karmic platform. And the other aspect of it is, it's meant to teach you something, even if it's a harsh lesson. I mean, look at it, Vinny. Fire. If you touch fire, you're burnt. Now, this could be a little teeny child. It can be a totally innocent. It could be a fly. It doesn't matter. Fire carries the capacity to extinguish the material bodies. So it isn't so much that you have to take it personal. It's that there was some error on your part and fire burnt you. So similarly, these psychopaths, they come into your life because somewhere down the line, you made an error and the door was kind of open for them to enter your life. Be patient, protect yourself, and fight back. They'll go away. Everything in the material world is temporary, and you can recover from it. You can't change them, but you can learn from them.
Oh, sure, you can recover from it, and I found the most valuable lessons I've learned have been those that have cost me the most. However,
yes,
I don't feel that I'm fully recovered at all.
Well, you end up scarred. If you cut your body, you maim your body, there is a scar. And it's the same thing with your mind. But you have to become a bigger person. That scar is not going to stop you. We see that all the time. People hold up someone who doesn't have legs, and they manage to put on mechanical legs and scale a mountain. And everybody goes, amazing courage, drive, determination, awesome inspiration. Well, you have to be that to yourself. You have to be an inspiration to get over the scars caused by psychopath and the injustices that people cause and the cruelty that they'll exhibit on you.
And you can't do that by drinking enough that you become legless.
Well, to be honest, many people take it differently. It is a personal thing, how you react. And that's the same thing with someone losing their legs. One guy may sit in a wheelchair the rest of his life and never get up. And the other guy may put on artificial legs and scale a mountain. So the reaction is over to your personal drive, determination, will, intelligence level, consciousness level. So that's the point. You just said that some of the best lessons you've learned have been the hardest lessons. And the point being is you overcome it. You don't allow the scars, you don't allow the pain, you don't allow the memory to keep you from being the best person you can be and continue to contribute.
What's problematic is that those memories don't go away. You know, like I'll go outside, like back when I was smoking, I'd like go outside and just have a cigarette, and then all of a sudden, bam, something from when I was 14 years old getting abused in high school or something comes into my mind and go, God damn it. You know, like I had to scream to get it out of my head kind of thing. You know, do you ever get that?
Well, everybody gets that. The whole idea is you have to have something to focus on that brings you back to your stability, equiposed. The intelligent being, the self-realized being, is equiposed in happiness or distress. And that's a level of spiritual realization we all need to come to, frankly, as soon as you can, because it makes whatever else you're facing doable, much more doable.
See, the way I deal with it is as I see wrong and right, sometimes very clearly. And when somebody does something wrong to me, it's a question about whether or not I can show people how wrong it is so that they don't have to learn the same lesson that I learned the hard way I learned it.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, as a result, people might be warned about a psychopathic criminal scumbag before
exactly.
even coming into contact with them. Am I costing people important life lessons? Do they need to be fucked over by that psychopath in order to feel whole, in order to get over those traumas, in order to grow from those experiences? Or is the act of warning people and preventing their suffering and protecting them in and of itself a way to make people weaker?
Okay, it's both. With one man, he'll take the warning and move aside. To another man, he'll go, oh, well, that's your opinion, Vinny, and blunder in. So the blunderer needed to have the hard way lesson. And the man who took heed of your warning, he deserved to miss the affair. He didn't have to learn it the hard way. Let's go a little bit step further on that. Generally speaking, there's two ways of learning. The one way of learning is personal experience, which everyone is so fond of. And the other way of learning is hearing from an authority. If I don't know the way to Auckland, I don't know the way to Canada, put it that way. I don't know the way to Canada. I can wander for a very long time, or I can have personal experience. Or I can go to someone and say, sir, which direction is Canada? And you reply to me, go north. and I can then go north and avoid all the pitfalls. I don't have personal experience, but I've been empowered by someone who has the knowledge, and the knowledge becomes my knowledge, and I can there empower another person, and we can all go to Canada if we desire. And it is the direct method. It's not the indirect method. So if you come across a person and you feel the impulse within you, that's the super soul, divine inspiration, encouraging you to warn this person. And you have to be detached from the result. They have their free will. One will heed the message and step aside. One will not heed the message and blunder.
You see, that's what they do on Facebook. Right. It's like, I'm giving you a warning, bro. Ah, I'm not taking your input. Block! And it's gone.
Well, life's like that. You can yell at somebody out the window, hey, there's a cop up ahead. And he might speed or he might slow down.
Well, in fact, it's funny you should mention the cop example, because I was driving home from my family's place up north, and as we were going around these blind, twisty corners on I think it was State Highway 16, they had these two motorcyclists, and they passed us around a blind corner on the opposite side of the road, right? Nearly getting killed by a car in the process. And so I slowed my van down and I indicated to the side of the road so that the other cyclist could get past me without risking his life.
Yeah.
And about 5 minutes later, we saw that both of them had been pulled over by a cop up the road.
Yeah, well, that's karma. Whatever you put
well, no,
into
actually,
the universe,
it's motorcycle
that's what you
ma.
Get back.
It's not karma, it's motorcycle ma.
Okay, it's motorcycle mojo.
Oh, God. Where do bad jokes come from? Are they,
Just you, Vinny. I never heard any from anybody else. The only bad jokes have all been yours, I'm pretty sure.
It's true. I am a plague upon
this. So, going a little bit further now. What we have is a contaminated environment that pure living entities are in and struggling with their material bodies as a form of imprisonment for the duration of a life. And the problem is that the environment tends to tarnish us. We get contaminated. So what we need is we need to understand, as we've discussed in the first half hour here, that we are the eternal living entity temporarily in the material body, and the experiences are meant to teach us and find the way to get out of the cycle of birth and death, return to the spiritual world of eternal happiness, knowledge, eternally, in a compatible service relationship with everyone there, including God. But in the meantime, we're struggling for existence, and we get periods of experience where we feel like I'm smothering in this. I can't get a break. I can't get out of the contamination or the bad influence that doesn't appear to be my own cause. And so in the Vedic literature, it's prescribed that one use sound vibration as a tool. If we look at the material manifestation, everything is in vibration. Scientifically speaking, the atom out. It's all in vibration. So the universal solvent is also a vibration. So there is a prescribed mantra for penetrating any type of contamination that you or I may have to face in the material world that keeps it from suffocating us so that we can continue to cleanse and be expressions of our real self, our real conscious point of view. So mantra meditation is the prescribed method for this age, when the age is characterized by hypocrisy and it's quarrel and it's misunderstanding. And we end up, and lack of truthfulness. These are the characteristics of the age: hypocrisy, quarrel, and a failing of truthfulness. So these things burn the heart, burn the mind of an honest man. When we're lied to and cheated and deceived, it angers us. It upsets us. It forms a type of contamination. And we need something strong and penetrative that will remove that, as you said a minute ago, like scar effect upon the mind, so that we can be equipoised. We can be resourceful with our intelligence. We can analyze and contemplate with good analytical ability without the effects of the scars tainting our future. So mantra vibration is the best because it's free. You have control of it. You can employ it anytime. It forms a center, a refuge. It forms a supportive energy flow and a cleanse.
So this is the way to actually get rid of, let's say, the unimportant side effects of suffering.
Yes, the lasting side effects. Yes. Yes.
Right. Like one side effect to suffering is you realize that the people who made you suffer come from an archetype of people that have very similar characteristics to the last group of people that made you suffer. And so you then recognize them and you stay away from them and you tell others to stay away from them too. Some people sure. You can't convince, but, you know, what are you going to do?
You do your best.
Yeah. Exactly. You plant seeds, even though you won't feel the shade of the tree. You won't ever be able to sit under it. And I feel that that's kind of like there's so much wondrous variety in not only the human experience but in human thought and emotions themselves that experiencing these things, like when I get angry, I get really angry. When I get sad, I get really sad. When I get happy, I get really happy, as if being at peace, like just calm, is something my mind and my body is not willing to accept, as though it does not value those experiences because you cannot suffer from them. And therefore, you cannot learn as much from them.
Well, what that really is that is exactly the contamination results that you find it difficult, we all find it difficult to find our calm center. This is why everybody's going towards yoga and exercises and meditation, because they're looking for some calm place where their natural peace and their natural humility is prevalent, is predominant. The results of these, like you were saying a moment ago, the results of these cheating, psychopathic, no good, rotten SOBs is you become angry. And the anger clouds your ability to get to that peaceful place. And you need some way of letting go of the anger. You undoubtedly have dealt with it. The argument lasted for 15 minutes. Who knows? You've driven off. You've gone home. You're sitting down trying to relax, and it's still niggling you and bothering you. Can't get away from it. So the residual stuff is what you're trying to get rid of, and you need something external to grab onto, just like putting a Band-Aid on it to stop the bleeding or something, to have a smoke to relax, whatever it might be. You need something, and a mantra meditation is that methodology. It's prescribed for the problem.
See, the way I've previously been dealing with it is I've got a reservoir of anger, a really huge one, a lake, if you will.
The Great Lakes.
And I realized that I could not drain this lake, but I could build a dam in order to keep it moderately contained and to draw energy from it so that I can power other areas in my life.
It's a type of inspiration. It's an aggravated inspiration.
So my hate, my anger, my rage, though they may cause me pain, without them I would not be as productive, or at least that's the current belief. That's the current
right.
mindset
Understood. You assume that because you haven't realized the how much more powerful you actually are when the hate, anger, and so forth is rinsed off.
Well,
if you look at it from
Can I correct you for a second there?
Yeah, yeah.
The reason why I think that is because over the last 8 years or so, I've been probably one of the angriest people I know. In fact, I probably still am. However, that has also allowed me to become one of the most productive people that I know, one of the most influential people that I know.
What you're talking about is motivation. You're deriving motivation from your anger and anxiety. But you can derive motivation from love and compassion. You can derive motivation from a sense of duty and honor, too.
I don't know how to do that, though.
I accept that, and that's because you're still on the lake.
Yeah, I'm still harnessing that river of rage.
Yeah. Okay, so you can see, however, that as you drain the river, a different type of effulgent energy shows itself to be under it. You don't have to think that when the lake is empty, I lose motivation. No, there is a transition. Yes, the anger type of motivation passes over the dam, but the new type of effulgent motivation shows itself and is even stronger. And the greater being, the greater Vinnie Eastwood, comes into existence. And this is what all people experience when they go to an enlightened state. And that's what we're talking about. The transition from a mundane anger, envy, greed, lust state to a compassionate, determined, righteous state. I mean, this is what's happening with you, Vinnie Eastwood. There is an honesty, a righteousness, a determination for truth in you that shines through. Even through your lake, right out of the bottom of your lake, shines this truth commitment on your part. So what would happen? What would it be like if you did drain the lake and that virile, strong commitment to truth came out in full force? It would certainly replace the motivation of your anger.
Well, I've just been thinking about it recently, and I try to protect people as best I can. There's a lot of people that I know that have suffered greatly.
Yes.
And
now you're talking about the good qualities that are inherently you. They're covered, so you have all these other expressions. But those good qualities, that's what a living entity is. And if we can uncover this stuff that's polluting us, the hypocrisy and the rage and the untruthfulness that's covering us, that's what the new society needs. We need to realize if we can bring out who we really are, it's what everybody needs, and everybody will benefit from everyone else's association.
The difficulty is with being really emotionally available like I am and actually having the amount of compassion for people suffering that I do, because I've been through similar stuff myself. I may have been oversimplifying it when saying it's the rage that motivates me. There's also a guardian aspect to me that I feel because I can hear people
out. This is fully described in the Vedic literature. It describes the four types of divisions in the human society that are naturally there. And one of those classes of men, he's compassionate. He is kind, he is generous, he is firmly fixed on the truth, and he is a born administrator and a guider of others. It's described in the Vedic literature. It's not unknown, it's a virtue. And this type of virtue is described.
What I find difficult is that people take those virtues and they say
– use them for their own purposes.
Yeah, they say, lead me, Vinny, lead me. I don't want to have to think for myself. It's like, sorry, I'm not going to do that for you. You know, I'm not going to make your decisions for you. I'll help you, and I'll be compassionate every time. But at the end of the day, you are kind of on your own. I can give you a hand here or there, and I might spend 2 hours of my time interviewing you and then 4 hours editing it and then another hour posting it around and so on and so forth. For you, you know, as a researcher or an activist, you know, theoretically speaking, they've spent their entire life doing for others what I'm only just now spending a little bit of time doing for them. And as a direct result, they get empowered. Finally, somebody recognizes what I'm doing. Somebody actually cares. And then they go out and they do even more activism. In fact, the best example that I can really cite about that was the Russell Malcolm case. I think in early 2000, he wound up getting the Rodney District Council, all of them, including the mayor, fired for corruption, you know. And then about 10 years later, just before the 2008 election, I believe, maybe the 2012 election, he got arrested and thrown in jail and had his internet access cut off and his home sold out from under him and his business shut down. And he was under surveillance by all of this kind of thing. And nobody would believe him. They think it was all just crazy and everything. I believed him. I believed him, and I got him to come around to my house to sit in front of the camera and my computer and to read his 52-page dossier about what happened to him. And then for 3 nights in a row, I stayed up without sleep with bedtimes of 6 a.m., 8 a.m., and 1 p.m. just to edit his speech, right, just to tell his story. Mm-hmm. I later found out that he was about to commit suicide at the time when I decided to help him. And because I did help him, because I spent that much time, because I did not ask for any money or anything in return, he is still alive today, and he is still exposing corruption.
So you've just proven my statement by example that if we as individuals come out of the selfish, I want, and stand on the platform of helping others who are in need with a compassionate mentality, the world would begin to heal. You just talked about healing one man, healed him from suicide, healed him from no one believing him. And this is the bottom of the level. You get, that's the bottom tier of depression. So look what we can do to the world, for our brothers and sisters who are actually no different than we are in the desire to be happy and exhibit their true pious characteristics. If we start universally understanding we should purify ourselves, we should live by compassion and honesty, we should give more than we take, and we should practice that as a standard and an example. That is the positive cycle. You need to have a scientific understanding. You need to have a realization of your role to play in the divine plan. And then the whole world can stop being dependent on psychopaths and people for food. And they start being dependent upon the goodness of reality, of humanity, of God's gift, of nature's bounty.
I feel that there's an absolute essential element to all of us, and that is to play your part in the greater role. A lot of people don't know their part, and I think
that's
that might
okay.
be because
I agree with
they're
you
not
completely.
Listening. They're not listening to their instincts, I think, is what it is.
Soul. They're not mm-hmm. listening to their super soul. I agree completely. And if they are taught who they're hearing, because the demons who run the planet, they're constantly saying, if you're hearing voice from within, it's a schizophrenic. No. God is there. As we are all children of the Father cares about his children. And he's there if you care. If you don't want to talk, he stays quiet. If you're there, you want help, he responds. And so we can all grow and develop our interaction with the supersoul, our divine interaction, our divine link within, and we can exhibit it externally. And we start to see how what happens outside matches with what you feel inside and vice versa, and you get a state of confidence and you get a state of fulfillment you can't get struggling for existence alone.
Well, we're social creatures, right? We need to actually be together. We need to be with one another, right?
Yeah.
And I found
we
that this is actually one of the most
it.
Yeah, it's one of the most important things, actually, because most people don't have that. They are
shall we say, they're alone, especially truthers, yes. Right?
But
people who believe in
training.
Things like...
This is social training, really. It's been going on for, well, all of our last five or six, seven generations. It's been going on that way. The isolation mentality is part of the demonic, satanic, New World Order operational mentality. Separate, divide, and conquer. Make people feel alone. They won't have the fulfillment of their natural characteristics. They won't feel vibrant. They won't try. And that's what we see. We've gotten down to the point where people are more or less cell phone zombies now. And they don't even realize it.
Are you
and
certain
so they feel
of this?
Alone.
I constantly see things getting worse and better at the same time. For
that's
everybody
right.
who heeds the warning, who follows the lesson, there's another 10 or 20 of them that completely ignore it. And they don't get shafted over instantly. This is the thing that I found is really difficult.
Well, Vinny,
just sort of thinking about it.
This whole material predicament is degrading. That's the characteristic of the age. But during this degradation, it's a great opportunity because part of this material manifestation is it's a place for you to learn your divine qualities. And you live under those divine qualities eternally in the spiritual world. But it's also a place where the shit that goes on is to make you not try to make a permanent settlement here. This isn't our home. This is a temporary place where we're learning. And so as it gets bad, the intelligent people go, this isn't my place. And the fools go, oh, well, what can you do?
I love it. They ask it as a rhetorical question. Oh, but what can I do about it? It's like you're supposed to try and answer that question yourself.
Yourself.
Okay, that's why it's got the label your life. Okay, you
and
know?
It's called self-realization.
It's like, hey, are you saying that other people can't run my life and determine my actions for me without terrible consequences that will basically deprive me of my own personhood?
Exactly!
Well, that's it. The mind is a muscle, and if you've not been trained, if it's not been used, if you don't have any fortitude in it, you're a limp wrist in the mind. But if you've lived a life that's got a little bit of rain in it, you get stronger and you find your way out. You fix yourself. You change your point of view. You strive to be a better being. You make sure your determination to be truthful stays firm. Well, that's what we have. Most of society has been covered and left into the comfortable, lethargic misconception, I can't.
The tree that has gone up against the most horrific hurricane force winds is the one with the deepest roots.
And stands the longest.
We have
eliminated. A little bit of rain may come into your life, but you can get through it and be a better being for it. That's called progressive consciousness.
Indeed. All right. Well, thank you very much for joining me today. And thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for listening. Check out my guest's radio show at rushfm.co.nz. That's rushfm.co.nz for the American listeners. And also,
We're also on iTunes and TuneIn.com. There's 30 shows on each of those, and we're also on freefm.org.nz. So we're getting all over the place.
Indeedy-do.
Thank you, Vinny. Thank you for your insights. Thank you for the opportunity to chat.
Cheers, brother. And thank you very much for playing the Vinny Eastwood Show on your network. All right.
Yes, definitely.
We'll see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for listening.